Welcome to Sports Business Secrets. I'm your host, Kevin Tarka. This podcast is specifically designed to share secrets from experts in the sports business world to help you along your own path to success in this industry. Each episode is packed with lessons and insights that never expire. You'll hear from general managers of professional teams to CEOs of sports tech companies to agents, coaches, players, and everything in between. I invite you to join me in real time on my personal journey of representing players and coaches, traveling the world, and always finding a way to battle through obstacles in this competitive industry.
Darren, welcome back to Sports Business Secrets.
I appreciate it, man. Am I first two-time guest here?
You know what? I went through it. I believe you are the first. Rerun. I had one on like a Marco Di Benedetto. I had him on like a group kind of panel. But yeah, this is the first individual run it back, which is super cool because you know, I think that just kind of speaks to the longevity of the podcast, but also the longevity of you in the industry. And it's, again, cool because you've kind of pivoted to a little bit of a different role, obviously, a different area of the sports business world, which we're going to educate the audience today. But yes, welcome back is the first time I've said that to a guest. So I'm pumped.
I love it. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me back on. It's been awesome seeing this journey for you too. Obviously listened to a lot of the podcasts, some great ones. And I mean, it's crazy to think about too, as we're talking through this. I mean, dude, like you and I met probably over a decade ago now. It's just crazy.
Yeah, that's incredible. Incredible, man. Oh, anyways. All right. Well, quick reminder for my guests here. If you want to hear the first episode, you can tune back to his previous recording. But for those who are unaware, Darren played basketball at Mercyhurst University. He went on to get his law degree from the University of Kansas. He spent some time practicing law as an associate attorney at several law firms in Chicago. And during that time, he represented pro basketball players and founded his own agency. So that's a lot about the last episode was a lot about the agency side of that and the law firm side. But then getting back into the coaching side was on his heart. So he dove back into the college basketball industry on the coaching side. And he spent 1 year as a director of operations at Indiana State, which we'll hear about, and his roles and responsibilities. And he's currently in his second year as his title is the special assistant to the head coach at Furman University, a role that I call one of those that has many hats, the GM, the chief operating officer, chief of staff, if you will. Yeah. So we'll dive into that. But for the sake of time and efficiency, you don't have to go deep into your background like we did last time. Again, people can tune back for that. But maybe I'll give you the stage here to almost update the audience on where you were last time when we recorded and where you're at now and what made you miss being involved in the college game and kind of what made you decide to make that transition.
I mean, great job summarizing there. We're good. Let's, you know, I think for me, 2020 hit. I'd been thinking about it for a while, for a number of reasons, which we can kind of obviously dive into now, but 2020 hit. And obviously we had the global pandemic, and I really missed the relationships, the passion, teaching the game, the X's and O's of it, the scouting. And I think there were some issues also evolving as part of representing athletes that I think more so on the international stage, which we can dive into more if you'd like, with the way some of these clubs operate, and the lack of ability to really have any ramifications from that. But first and foremost, I missed being in deeply involved with the relationships and the passion that's involved on the team side and teaching the game. And so I made the decision to leave representing players and leave practicing law. Was fortunate enough, very, very grateful, forever grateful to Josh Schertz, who's the head coach at Indiana State right now. Him giving me an opportunity to get back onto the team side. He had just accepted the role, a mutual friend of ours, one of my close friends, Cody Topper, was kind enough to really vouch for me. And I had built a relationship with Josh, and you know, it, so it worked out incredibly well. And so I was able to join Indiana State for the 21-22 season as director of basketball operations.
Love it. I love it. And we'll go into that in one second, because I want you to educate the audience a little bit on kind of what your roles are as a DOBO, for those unaware, that's the term, director of basketball operations. So just real quickly, I mean, I think a lot of listeners can benefit from hearing just the mindset of that transition, whether you're an athlete transitioning from playing into the real world, or whether you're a coach that wants to get into the agent world, or an agent that wants to get out. Like, it's not an easy transition. So and obviously with you know, practicing law, and if you will, having a, you know, awesome, high paying, stable like career, right? You had to bet on yourself, right? And you had to give that up in order to get to, you know, where you wanted to be. So what was that transition like? Like, what was going through your mind? And it's not, and by the way, like, it's I say this a lot, it depends on where you are in your life. And like me being, you know, not married and not having kids is a very different situation than somebody that has to support a family. So talk about that process a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, by no means, you know, I'd like to say, I think on the surface, it was an easy decision because of my passion and my love for the game of basketball and being on this team side coaching. But yeah, I mean, there are layers to it, right? I mean, you know, you did have to make a financial sacrifice. You know, you did have to make sacrifices of, you know, we lived in downtown Chicago, right? And, you know, you got to potentially move to some other places. I mean, obviously Indiana State was in Terre Haute, Indiana. And so, you know, there are a number of sacrifices, right? My wife had to be on board with it. We had a 18-month-old daughter, you know, that had to up and move. And so, a lot of credit, honestly, truly to my wife, Julie. She does work in sports, so she has a good idea and understanding of kind of what it takes and what goes into it. But she's been incredibly supportive throughout the whole process. And frankly, was kind of one of the people pushing me to say, look, like, I know how passionate you are about this. I've seen you do this before. Cause I was at Chicago State when we met, and so I think she saw and knew how good I could, you know, could be in it, and saw my passion for it and how much I missed it. And so she was super supportive, which ultimately did make it a lot easier. But yeah, I mean, there are a number of things that you have to do just kind of in life, you know, life decisions that you have to make and you have to go through in order to make the transition. So on the surface, it was easy, you know, but it was a major lifestyle shift and lifestyle change. All for the better ultimately. But yeah, you know, I mean, there were a lot of moving parts to get the family, even just 3 hours away from Chicago to Terre Haute, Indiana for that first year.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And talking about the lifestyle shift and let's say the day to day. So it's probably a great transition to talk about what you actually did. I mean, there's a difference between being on the phone all day, repping professional basketball players internationally and practicing law, then going into being a director of basketball operations for a team. So can you just take and you don't have to go in depth, but just like an overall summary of what a director of basketball operations does.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I mean, historically, and traditionally, your director of basketball operations typically will run the day-to-day operations of the program. So that will be travel, that will be organization of food, that will likely have a role in the budget and monitoring the budget throughout the season. You know, essentially, a lot of times, you know, you'll be, depending on where you're at, you will have gear responsibilities to make sure that all the guys have what they need, and the staff. So a lot of the day-to-day program operations is kind of what you see traditionally in a director of basketball operations role. Not necessarily on the court as much, but as you know, a lot of programs kind of run things differently and guys fill certain roles. You know, the way things worked out at Indiana State, they needed somebody to come in that had a knowledge and an ability to handle travel and, you know, and food logistics and some of the day-to-day operations that I could handle. But that role there in particular was a little bit different too, in that, I was fortunate enough to be able to have, you know, as much as I could be from an NCAA perspective, as much hands-on basketball that than maybe other guys in that role. You know, player development opportunities. I did a lot of our advanced scouts for opponents, and you know, had in-game responsibilities, post-game responsibilities. So I would say personally there, like I had a lot more basketball responsibility in addition to handling the day-to-day operations. And then obviously I handled, because of my background, and then obviously with NIL that year, July 1 coming into play, you know, I handled all our NIL, all our NIL stuff as well. But I, you know, I had a bit of a unique role as Dobo at Indiana State, in that while I did have the operation stuff, I did have a lot of basketball involvement as well. So it allowed me to kind of really carve out kind of a unique role, you know, that had the traditional director of basketball operations job responsibilities, you know, but also the ability to be heavily involved on the basketball side, from teaching the game, coaching the game, and helping prepare for upcoming opponents.
Yeah, I think obviously every Dobo has a little bit of a different role depending on where you're at, but that you know, your role seemed like it prepared you well for, again, the GM, the chief of staff role anyways, because you were kind of handling a lot of different things. And, you know, again, I really wanted you just to give an overview, and now to really dive into the main conversation of your role now. So obviously, being a director of basketball operations, you still kind of do some of that stuff, like being the special assistant to head coaches. You know, I call it, again, you're COO, you're the GM, you're the chief of staff, you're the glue guy. You do what needs to get done. But there are a lot of back end responsibilities on the business side that I really want to highlight on this episode, which is why we decided to, you know, record one again. So maybe you can start out with, first, just kind of explaining, you know, your role and where you're at. I mean, Furman University, some people might not be familiar with it. Talk about Furman, talk about your role, and then we'll jump into like specific business side questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So, for those of you that don't know, Furman is a top 70 liberal arts school in the country, in Greenville, South Carolina, which is just a booming area. Unbelievable campus, unbelievable infrastructure, great education, and a history of athletic success. And so the opportunity to come down here also to be a part of a staff with Bob, you know, Bob Ritchie, our head coach, who's a just phenomenal leader and phenomenal basketball coach and even better person, was an opportunity that I couldn't pass up. You know, obviously, just briefly digressing a little bit, got to get this one in. I mean, you know, the opportunity to go to the NCAA tournament and knock off Virginia last year was an incredibly special moment, not only for us as a staff and us as a program, but an incredible moment for the university. So, you know, I think hopefully Furman will continue to grow and be kind of continue to be put on the map in that perspective. So. To kind of dive into,
you beat me to it, because that was gonna be my first question about Furman, man. I mean, that was incredible. If you haven't watched the highlights, at least of that game, that was an incredible win last year.
It was, and I appreciate it. I mean, it's something that it's pretty cool to say that, you know, you were a small part of what will honestly be an iconic March Madness moment for the next decade. The way that game transpired, the way it ended, you know, us hitting that game winner, it was a pretty special moment personally, but obviously a very special moment for Bob and our staff and our players in the university. You know, so it's kind of it's a special moment to kind of always cherish, that frankly most people don't really get to have that experience. Not only be able to play in an NCAA tournament, but win a game, and do it in the fashion that we did. And, you know, so obviously very, very, very special. But, you know, coming here, Bob does a really good job kind of having foresight as to where things are going. He really studies not only the game, but studies the business of it and studies kind of the trends of really trying to be a step ahead. And so there was an opportunity that opened up here, and he wanted to kind of go a little bit different route with having somebody with the NIL landscape and the growing need for really someone to help kind of run the business that has really become a college basketball program, which we can dive into more. Was looking for kind of somebody to fill a unique role. And so with my business background and my basketball background, it was a really good fit for what he was looking for, what I think I really wanted to do too. And so it was a great opportunity to really come in and, like you said, kind of be the COO, be the chief of staff, the general manager, kind of however you want to phrase it. Having to be a jack of all trades in some respects, but really focusing on the business side of it. And so a lot of what I do here is, you know, I run our NIL. I'm the liaison between our program and our collective. I'm heavily involved in our fundraising with our current high level donors, our current, donor base, and looking to continue to grow, right? Because, in this new era in particular, fundraising has never been more important for college basketball programs and college programs in general. But, we are really at a point where, Furman men's basketball, just like, Program X men's basketball, has become a business. I mean, Bob is running a legitimate business organization at this point. And so you really have to have that understanding. And I think you have to have people in place that can help you manage that, help take as much off your plate as possible so that he can focus on coaching basketball as much as he can. And just alleviating some stress of just the myriad of things that are put on his plate. Those are kind of, some things that I have really tried to take on and lead. And as this NIL landscape has evolved and changed, really tried to stay ahead of it, stay educated, and be at the forefront of ways that we can maximize our program's growth through this, but at the same time keeping the culture that we want and that Bob has built and cultivated, which is incredibly important in this current landscape with the portal and with the ability to move around quickly. And I think some of the changes that we've just seen in the culture of American basketball probably over the last 10, 15 years of where and how it's evolved.
Yeah. So a lot to dissect there. So I'm going to try and go, and I have notes on a couple here. I'm going to try and go one by one. So you beat me to the word fundraising, because I was going to mention that in one of the transitions, but fundraising, it's a really interesting concept that maybe we can hash out here, because when you start to think about it, it's like, okay, we talk about basketball being a business because it is. And then we talk about fundraising, and it's like, almost you're like, okay, well, if basketball is such a big business, then why do a lot of schools have to fundraise? Well, that's kind of the reality of where college basketball is right now. So maybe you can can you give your thoughts on just fundraising and actually maybe just explain like who you're fundraising from, and every school is going to be different, but who you're fundraising from, and then what both A, you're allowed to use those funds for, and where you guys actually spend those funds, because it all ties into NIL, right? And again, I don't have to dive into a summary of that now, but maybe you could talk about it in your answer. But yeah, just explain a bit more about the fundraising side, because some listeners that understand NIL know that's what it's about and what that new role is kind of about, but a lot of people don't.
Yeah, I mean, it has never been a more important piece of college athletics than it is now. At its core, at the end of the day, in order to be able to help put ourselves in the best situation possible to provide our guys with the highest level of care that we can, we have to be able to go supplement our budget. As almost everybody has to do, whether you're Duke, Kansas, Carolina, Kentucky, or Furman, Indiana State, whatever it might be, you have to be able to kind of create a pot, for lack of a better term, of, funds to be able to do what you want to do to build the program that you want to build and how you want to build it and what you want to focus on with that. And so, when we fundraise, we obviously look, we have a very strong culture here. And that's incredibly important to us. And Bob has done an incredible job cultivating and building that culture. So I think at its core, that's one of the things that we really stress and that we really emphasize when we are fundraising is look, like, we have a standard here and we are here to look. We all know we got to win basketball games, right? We don't win basketball games, we don't have jobs. But at the end of the day, there is a strong understanding of there is more to it. And we really pride ourselves on putting our money where our mouth is and providing and creating an incredible experience for our guys that not only helps them be as best as they can be on the court, be as prepared as they can be on the court, and have the, for lack of a better term, the things that can best prepare them to be at their best on the court. We also have a significant desire and investment in building these guys up and preparing them off the court as well. And so when we go to fundraise, it's a real holistic approach of, we want to build this war chest so that we can provide our guys with that opportunity and provide our guys with those things so we can eat as well as we can, so we can travel as best as we can, so we can make sure that our guys are getting the best strength training that they can. It's a lot of these little things, right? Obviously there are some major things that play a role in, what helps make the program better, but a lot of it comes down to these smaller-ish things that really aren't small, but may seem that way, but that allow us to really differentiate ourselves, but also at the same time, provide our guys with the highest level experience here, that we can. I think that there is a obvious correlation between that and NIL now, because to your point, it's become a situation where you have to be able to have disposable funds to be able to navigate this system, and to recruit talent and to retain talent. But for us, fundraising is really about trying to, find folks that obviously probably have a connection to the program, but also I think share in the passion that we have to try and provide our guys with the best, highest level experience that we can provide them. Again, not only for preparation for game day and leading up to it, but also what can we do to help prepare these guys to grow as young men here and beyond? Because at the end of the day, we are teachers, we are mentors, and there are moms and dads that are basically entrusting us with their, their young men. And so we take that role very seriously. And so, those are things that I think really allow us to be able to go out and, have some success in making sure that we can build that up to be able to provide those guys with the experience and opportunity that we, that we want to do here. And Bob has done a great job building that. And look, we're very grateful and we're very lucky. We have some folks that are, that have made significant impacts on our program. It's really helped us be able to have some of that success, and their passion and their generosity is massive. And we are incredibly grateful to have them be a part of this with us, because that's what it really comes down to. I mean, they are entrenched in this with us. And, and I think we have a little bit of a unique aspect in that, and so I think that's been really cool seeing that grow and how we've been able to cultivate that. The fundraising piece is huge. I mean, there's no doubt. At the end of the day, it's a necessary piece of building a program in 2024.
Yeah, and I love the way you talked about the holistic approach, because I don't think enough programs talk about that, where, yes, there's going to be revenue generated, or let's say, fundraised, obviously. But a lot of that, when people think NIL, it's like, okay, let's fundraise money and pay players directly. I mean, of course, there's going to be an aspect of that where the collective's involved, brands are involved, and you're able to obviously schools not directly, but collectives are able to coordinate deals with brands to get payers played. Like that's at the end of the day what NIL was created for. Right. But the way that you talked about being able to use those funds to provide elite a 360 degree elite care for your guys, whether that is better food when you're eating out, or travel plans, or being able to charter somewhere if you need mm-hmm. to, or staying in nicer hotels, or different sorts of products and services to help the mind and the body, or the facilities. Like that's all part of the piece that you need at the end of the day for recruiting. And again, every single conference, every single team is different, where you might have to recruit a player that wants more of that, let's say weighted towards being able to get funds directly, or being able to go to a school that has all of those extra perks and services. And it's just interesting, right? And that kind of leads me into my next question about recruiting, is like, okay, well, what how has that changed the way you guys have been able to recruit? And do you specifically recruit a type of person, a type of young man that do you find your recruits needing certain things more than others? Like how does this whole piece play into recruiting?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a great question, because I think recruiting has changed drastically over the last couple of years, especially obviously with NIL being a part of it now. I think we're very strategic in recruiting. And I think, it's important for us, for people to want to be here for the right reasons, right? I mean, we've got a degree here, right? And we want guys here that want to be here for that degree. They want to be here for the name on the front of the jersey. Look, the name on the back of the jersey absolutely matters. We get that, right? But the name on the front of the jersey is what's going to win out, in the end. And so we really try to focus on finding guys that they want to be here because of the whole package. But there's no doubt that in today's landscape, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this later too with the portal, there's no doubt in today's landscape, there are guys that are coming to programs or that are being reached out to by programs that essentially have a, almost like a list of demands of what, what they want, what they expect. And, it's definitely complicated things in a lot of respects, because of the lack of ability to have any transparency in what the NIL landscape is right now. And obviously player empowerment, student athlete empowerment is at probably a peak point from what it's been, which is great to have guys have more of a voice. But obviously I say that to say that impacts, how kind of, recruiting can go at times. But I think for us, the big thing is really just finding the right guys, right? Because I think if you can really focus on the front end of really vetting and doing your due diligence on the front end, you have a stronger chance to be able to get the right guys in initially, and show those guys the level of care that we talk about, to the point of where, they love it and they want to continue to be a part of that. But on the front end, if you can do that and you can get the guys that want to be with you because of everything that's involved, they want the degree, they want to be a part of a real team and a group of I think a staff that really, and there are a lot of great staffs out there, but I do think a staff that from top to bottom genuinely cares about our guys' well-being first and foremost, I think that allows us to navigate this thing pretty well. But the waters, like I said, have definitely gotten murkier, and it's definitely made recruiting a little bit more complicated based on how you have to kind of approach it, and I think how you have to respond to certain aspects of it.
Yeah, and you're starting to see, if you're in the audience, you're starting to see what I talk about a lot is the analogies between recruiting from the agent side, which obviously you have experience with, and recruiting from the college side, is very similar. It's like, you know, you really need to understand what student athletes or what these athletes that are turning pro want and what's important to them. Because if you do tackle some of those questions and desires and needs and communicate on the front end, then you really save yourself from a situation that could be just not good for anybody involved on the back end. So, and that kind of leads me into my next question of, and again, it's very similar from the agency perspective of, okay, recruiting's difficult. You have to have the right fit. You have to, you have to want the same things as the athlete does, but also like the reality needs to match that, right? So if both of you say, yeah, if you tell the athlete, yeah, you're going to go to the NBA, and they're like, yeah, I want to go to the NBA, but they're not on any draft boards, it's like those don't match up, right? But the question is more about retaining talent, which is interesting from the college perspective now. And you touched on it a little bit before, like this really just brings us into the portal conversation, I guess. So feel free to talk about that. But how do you retain talent there? Like, besides talking about handling on the front end of getting the right guys that are in there for the right reasons, but it's free agency essentially. And so on one hand you say, hey, like, I understand that a student athlete now wants to test the market, or if they play well, they can level up and they can, you know, make more NIL money or get a different degree, whatever. How do you retain talent? Like, what's that environment like now?
Yeah, I'll say this. I think there are a couple things that stand out initially, and I think it's things that you want to try and focus on and want to try and do. And one is relationships, right? I think with this NIL era, things have become increasingly transactional. And I think if you're really, if there's a real level of deep care for your guys, I think that at the end of the day, that shows through from the top down, from your head coach to, tech to your student managers. If there's a supreme level of care and you genuinely value the relationships, I think you are a step ahead to be able to retain your guys. Because at the end of the day, man, I mean, look, we're all human, right? And when you feel valued, when you feel there's a genuine relationship, when you feel someone genuinely cares about your well-being, but can also coach you at a really high level, and can really put you in positions to be as successful as you want to be as a player. But I think also having the understanding too of the academic piece and the off the floor piece, you put yourself in a really good driver's seat to be able to retain guys. That said, there's no doubt that because of the ability to move more, you're recruiting every day. You're recruiting your own guys, but like I said, I think when I say recruiting your own guys, I genuinely think it's less about the actual recruiting process and more of just, if you show your guys you genuinely care and you invest that time, which is not easy at times, because there's so much going on. But if you do those things, I am a firm believer that your guys and their families are going to see that. And, the ones that really get it, they're going to understand that that's not the case at a lot of places anymore. And, if you have that relational aspect, I do think that really puts you a step ahead and puts you in a really good position to be able to retain talent and to be able to retain your guys. And again, I harp back, I kind of go back to getting the right guys initially. If you can get guys that fit your culture and what you're trying to build early, I think it does help you on the back end as well. And then I think that the last piece I'd say to that is, the ability to, to really focus on, providing that elite level of care, really puts you in a good spot to be kind of ahead of the game. But it is become increasingly, it has become, I should say, increasingly transactional with the portal. And the lack of rules and the lack of ability to kind of keep an eye on things, has made it challenging at times.
Yeah, and another thing I wanted to ask about before that you just reminded me with that last statement is culture, right? Like I'm a big culture guy. I've been lucky enough to be involved with programs from my high school team and coach all the way through college, obviously, where culture is just huge to me. You know, it's about family, it's about developing. I've been surrounded by people that genuinely care, which I'm super grateful for and super lucky for, because that's not everybody. And that's, you know, obviously 4 years of high school, 4 years of college. Now with this new kind of you know, the modern college basketball environment we're in makes it a lot more difficult to develop a culture. What are your thoughts on that? Because again, culture to me is, you know, when alumni come back because they want to stay involved with the program. Culture to me is, you know, like having those relationships beyond the 4 years you're there. Culture is developing over those 4 years, and like you can't build a culture overnight, obviously. So in today's environment, how have you guys been able to build that culture year over year?
Now, great, great question. And I'm so glad you bring it up, because it was one thing that I had wanted to mention as part of that last question. And so I'm really glad you brought it up, because it's such an important piece. It has obviously become increasingly hard to be able to create a culture and to build a true program. You know, you have with the portal now such an ability, almost like NBA free agency, to flip your roster on a yearly basis. And when, you know, like you said, you can't build a program culture overnight. And frankly, you can't build it in 9 months. And so, you know, it is increasingly difficult to be able to build a program, because of guys coming in and out. But also too, you look at I think some places realize, well, shoot, we can, you know, they don't necessarily fully understand the culture piece, and they look at it and, well, we can turn the program around on a yearly basis now because of the portal. So I do think windows, in order to win and build quickly, the window of time you have to try and build a program, I think, has decreased significantly in a lot of places. And you know, so that has added to the difficulty of it. Because look, I mean, the reality is sometimes it's going to take It might take a full 3-4 year cycle to get your guys in to build that culture. And in a lot of places now, you're not going to be given that runway to do so. And so you have to be really strategic. You have to really stand by your values. And I think you really have to think about it, right? Like, I mean, you know, you played at a very high level. You know what a good culture is like, and you know what one that isn't as good of a culture is like. And so I think when you're building it as a head coach and as a staff, like, again, I go back to the fact that as a head coach, you run probably what isn't even anymore a small business, right? You run a corporation, basically. And I think, you know, look, if you're a CEO of a corporation, what are some of the things that you're going to be thinking about in running that corporation, right? You're going to be thinking about leadership. You're going to be thinking about what culture you want. And so I think you really have to take the time to map out what it is that you want to do. And you have to be incredibly strategic and incredibly meticulous in building that. And I think, like I said, it's just become increasingly difficult to be able to do that. So I think, you know, you have to be smart with the portal. I think look, I mean, there's a need for it, in that it can absolutely fill needs, especially if you lose a guy that maybe is a junior, or who's played for a couple of years. Maybe it's a guy that's got an additional year, where you can be a grad transfer, etc. Some of the older guys, you know, the portal can play a big role because you can bring someone in there with experience. Whereas a lot of times the high school guys, obviously they just don't, you know, they don't have the experience. But you know, it is absolutely been increasingly difficult, and it's a slippery slope with the portal. Because it's just, like I said, it's really hard. It's become harder to build it the way you want to be able to build it from the ground up.
So with your law background, kind of summarizing and circling back to both the NIL stuff and this conversation we just had, like, I think the question whether college athletes should be employees has been looming over the industry for, you know, a few years now. It seems like we're closer and closer with, you know, the House of Representatives moving forward with some bills and, you know, potentially closer to some national rules here, federal legislation. I guess the question, I don't want to ask what's the answer because that's a long conversation, but, you know, where do you see the NIL space going from a legal perspective over the next couple of years?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's another great question. Man, I think if I had the true answer to that, man, I'd be a rich man pretty quick. but you know, I think all jokes aside, I think the future of NIL it's not going away. It's here to stay. I think the quicker, and I think most people at this point have embraced it, right? I think the first year, maybe year and a half, there were a lot of people that just didn't want to embrace it. But I think for the most part, people have embraced it now. But I think if you haven't, you have to, and you're way, way behind if you haven't, because it's here to stay, and you have to figure out a way to navigate through it. And I think you have to try and stay on the forefront of understanding it as best that you can, with the changes that are seemingly happening on a daily basis. But I don't necessarily know, you know, exactly where it's going to go, but I do know it's here. You know, I think you probably heard this, you know, and I think a lot of people that are listening to this have probably heard it as well. You know, Rick Pitino's comments about a salary cap type scenario, you know, with transparency to the league office. I personally think that is the model that we need to try and go towards, where you know, there is a salary cap at that is created, probably at the conference level with the input from coaches and athletic directors and presidents. You know, I think if we can go more of that route, you've got an understanding then of what you can spend. Everybody in the league has at least an understanding of that. And there's just then more transparency in the recruiting process. There's less things going on, I think, under the table, whether they're legal or not. You know, there's just a lot of scenarios where if you're recruiting a kid, especially more so in the portal, just because I think there's so much money being thrown around in the portal that you don't necessarily know what a kid's been offered by other places. And so I think if you can create a salary cap scenario, you create a little bit more of a level playing field, which, without diving too deep into it, as we know it at the NBA level, is there to try and help create some competitive balance. And so, you know, I think that's a really good approach. And I think that's the most realistic approach. And I'm not saying that's the perfect model. But I do think that allows us to have a little bit more of an ability to have an understanding of what we can do, and an understanding of what everybody can spend and where they can spend it. Now, where some of that gets tricky is that just the Power Five and the Big East and basketball? You know, does the AAC get thrown into that? What happens to our league? What happens to Southern Conference? What happens to the Missouri Valley? What happens to the Mountain West? You know, I can go on and on and on. You know, how do those conferences play a role into that? And, you know, I do think we potentially are trending towards a path where there is going to be some separation. A lot, I think, will depend on football and what they want to do. Do they completely break off and do their own thing at the Power Five level, or some of the just top level schools at the Power Five level? As you know, because there was, as you probably remember, there was conversation about, you know, that trust fund created for kind of the most elite type schools to be able to participate in. You know, so we'll see where that goes. But I do think more transparency is needed. And I think a salary cap type structure, personally, you know, works better than the unionization piece. You know, this is a whole, I mean, this could be podcast number three, you know, just talking about this in particular. But I think the unionization of student athletes gets really complicated. And by no means am I going to sit here and tell you that I am a labor lawyer, you know, but at the same time, you know, I don't quite think these guys know exactly what it takes as part of a unionization process. Not only just to unionize, but then you have to collectively bargain, and what somebody at it, you know, what somebody in the Big Ten wants to collectively bargain is probably going to be something yeah. different than somebody in the SEC wants to collectively bargain. And are we really going to put 18 to 22 year old kids as, you know, president of the union and vice president of the union, and hey, these 10 guys are going to help negotiate collective bargaining, a collective bargaining agreement for either our league or, you know, or for all student athletes in general. And then, you know, you're getting down another slippery slope of basketball and football are vastly different in themselves. And then you've got Olympic sport. I mean, just where I think the unionization piece, I guess, simply put, I think it's incredibly complicated, and I'm not sure how I see that fitting. I also personally don't love the employee piece of this.
Yeah.
You know, look, I'm not an idiot. Like, I get, you know, heck, I played Division II ball, and I was doing more than, you know, than I was more than just a student athlete, right? I mean, it's a massive commitment. So I don't want to belittle that by any means, but I think we have better avenues to still see these guys as more than, you know, your quote unquote student athlete, but at the same time, you know, being able to make sure that they are taken care of and that they are being able to maximize their NIL, but within something that I think is just more manageable and probably more realistic, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's a, I mean, some of the points you said, it's just, it's a deep and complicated process. I mean, I personally, the salary cap conversation is really interesting. I think it would have to be conference level. So that just is going to continue to, the way I phrase it is eliminate the middle class. I mean, it's going to be the big boys and then, like, you know, small conferences, which is the reality of life right now. So that's interesting, but I don't know. Can you have a salary cap without, can you have a salary cap without student athletes being employees? I don't know if that's even possible, right? So that just complicates it even more.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. You know,
technically there'll just be more lawsuits and there'll be more antitrust situations. And so, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, the salary cap is collectively bargained at the NBA level, right? You know?
Right.
So, it's a great point. I'd have to think that there'd be a way to be able to do that where you could still potentially have some student athlete involvement, but that you maybe wouldn't have to fully unionize to be able to do that. You know, maybe it comes at the institutional level. And so, you know, you kind of then know up front, like if you're coming to that school, like you got a little bit of an idea of what the salary cap in that league is. But it's a great point you bring up, that I don't have a good answer to on that.
Yeah. You know, maybe we'll save that for episode three. So we'll give that some time. Well, look, man, this has been great. As we start to wrap up here, I know we talked about a lot of different things, but what there's obviously no playbook, for success right now in college basketball industry, and especially for your role as the chief of staffs and the GMs of the college basketball world start to be more common. But I'm curious as to who you look up to in the industry, or who you get your advice from, or who you get mentorship from, or are there certain people that you kind of look to, whether it's in college or the pro space, to base your kind of strategy off of?
Yeah, absolutely. There, you know, I think in my role, given that it's unique, and that there's still basketball involvement, but it's also more of that front office type role. I think I look to a lot of people. I look at coaches and I look at front office executives in the NBA. is kind of guys that I study or that I look up to or that I want to learn more from. You know, I mean, Bob Myers, what he was able to build in San Francisco with the Warriors. He's a guy that I try to study and I try to listen to anything that he has to say. He's incredibly smart. And I think what a lot of what he built, yeah, I mean, did they get great talent? 100%. But there is a culture there, and there are things that he built and helped build that I think are bigger than just X's and O's on the floor. So he's a guy that I look to. You know, I think I look to the Heat culture. I mean, I think that's crazy from the standpoint of they basically have been able to build a program, for lack of a better term, a culture, the NBA level, which is incredibly difficult to do. But I think that starts with Pat Riley on
Pat down. Riley, yeah.
And obviously Eric Spoelstra is one of the best coaches in the game. And what they've been able to build, but you listen to people that have played for them. You watch them, you just kind of see what they do and how they operate. Everything's strategic. There's a certain way they're going to play. There's a certain way they're going to develop. There's a certain level of expectation of how they're going to do things. And
off the court as well.
Off the court as well. Absolutely. And so I think you've seen great success there. So I look a lot at that. You know, the college level. Look, I've had the opportunity in the past 3 years to work for two of the best in the business, in Josh Hertz and Bob Ritchie. And so I look at both those guys and I study those guys of what they've been able to do, how they've built what they've built. You know, and they do things in different ways. Neither is right, neither is wrong. But it's been a unique opportunity to see how both of them have done it. And, you know, they're phenomenal at what they do. And so, you know, I study those guys and you know, I think Bill Self is another guy that I look to, what he's been able to build, and what he does, and how he runs that program. You know, and then some younger guys, that I think are incredibly sharp minds and guys that will be head coaches, if they have not been already, you know, Zach Bovaer, who I worked with at Indiana State, and, you know, Cody Toppert, obviously now it back being a head coach with the, Capital City Go-Go in Washington. But, you know, those are a few names that I definitely study, look to, and see, because all those guys have had great success and they're incredibly intelligent and they're incredibly sharp and very good at what they do.
Love it. I love it. Yeah. Bill Self's, however I can get onto that unlimited contract or whatever they called it. What's it called? The lifetime contract.
Yeah.
If you can get a lifetime contract, man, I'm going to study how he did that for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know,
man, that's great. Well, look, man, I appreciate you coming on, man. We have a lot of new concepts here that I think the audience is going to appreciate with the, let's call it the modern day of college basketball, which again, you know, we could maybe have put something on the calendar for episode 3, because these are topics that I think are going to be ever changing. So I appreciate you bringing on your expertise. And then, you know, I have to leave you with the infamous sports business lightning round, like last time. And it's going to be interesting to see. I'm sure I changed a couple of questions, but some of them will be the same. So we'll see how you've changed your likes here over the years. So here we go. What's your favorite color?
Red.
Do you prefer coffee or tea?
Oh, coffee. I'm a coffee nerd all day. One quick thing on this. I'm a huge coffee guy. And what I do is when we go on the road or when I go to certain cities, I go to the local spot and I always love bringing a bag of beans back.
Oh, I love that.
It makes the mornings at home a lot more fun, because you've got that memory of where you were. So coffee all day.
Love that. Do you prefer pizza or pasta?
Pizza. Love pizza. Deep dish Chicago. I'm from Chicago. Chicago guy. I love deep dish pizza.
Chicago or New York pizza?
Chicago, but I'm biased. I mean, I'm from there. I love Chicago pizza all day.
Would you rather be able to speak to all animals or speak 4 languages fluently?
Man, that's a real tough one. But I gotta say, I think I'd like to speak to animals. It'd be so curious to know what's going through their minds. Like my dog, I'd love to know what my dog is thinking on a daily basis, right? Like, I feel like the languages would be amazing. But most people speak English, or you can figure out a way to kind of navigate getting to somebody. But man, I'd love to know what some animals think.
Very true. What's your favorite country outside the one you're in now?
Italy. Italy
What's
by
one of your,
far.
go ahead.
I just say Italy.
What's one of your biggest strengths?
I think building relationships with people. I do think I've been blessed with a gift to be able to really relate to a lot of different people and really have a good understanding of people, and build relationships and try to put ourselves in the best situation to grow.
Who's one of the first people to really believe in you?
My high school basketball coach John Meyer. I would have to say he's one of the first. Obviously, special relationship there with a guy that really kind of helped get me to where I am today.
What is one of your biggest fears?
Mediocrity.
If you could have dinner and drinks with anyone in the world, dead or alive, who's one of the first people that pops in your mind?
Man, so this is such a tough question because there's so many. But we were having a conversation the other day. And Winston Churchill came up. And so when I was looking, when I was thinking about some stuff here, like it's like, man, what he did, what he had to go through, I would tell you Winston Churchill. Just would love to pick his brain about how he led through extreme difficulty, how he kept everyone motivated and kept the belief alive that we were gonna win the war, even when it wasn't looking good. Just an incredible leader and an incredible speaker. So I think Winston Churchill would be a guy that I would absolutely love to be able to sit down with and have dinner.
That might be the first Winston Churchill answer. I love it. And then last one here, I'm gonna switch it up a little bit. And I think last time I said, if you could turn back time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell him? But I'm gonna say, if you could turn back time and talk to yourself right after we recorded the last podcast, when you were still practicing law and when you were still an agent, what would you tell that Darren?
I think I'd say, look, follow your passion, and follow what you love, and work as hard as you can to educate yourself to be the best that you can be and build that path and build relationships. Because at the end of the day, I think in any walk of life, but I do think especially with sports, so much of it's about relationships. And so, I think there's got to be a happy median, especially when you have a family, of making sure your family's taken care of. But I do think life is too short to not enjoy and love what you do. I mean, I have a friggin' get to job. I don't have a have to job.
Love it.
I think that a lot of times it was prior it was a have to. But what I'm doing right now, I mean, I get to do this. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
Yep, that's awesome. Yeah, and great advice to yourself, and you followed it to a T. It's been fun to see that. I remember when you told me about that pivot, and everything's coming to fruition for you, man. And I'm happy for you, and hopefully we'll get to see you guys in the NCAA tournament again this year.
Hey,
Another first round upset. Let's go.
that's what we're shooting for. No, it should be fun. It's the best time of year, right? We're 2 weeks away from conference tournament time, and
It's gearing
like
up.
a month away from March Madness. So hopefully we can be in the one shining moment video again this year.
Let's go. Let's go. Speaking into existence. All right, brother. I appreciate you coming on. We'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me. This is wonderful. Appreciate it.
Thanks again for listening, my friends. If you enjoyed the episode or if it brought you any value at all, it would mean the world to me if you could give it a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. If you share it on social media, make sure you tag me at Kevin Tarka. If there are any topics that you want me to dive into or any guests you'd love for me to have on the show, just shoot me a message and I will do my best to make it happen. Have an amazing day and hope to see you back here soon.